Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for July's Nurses Club webinar. I'm delighted to introduce you to our speaker for today, European veterinary specialist and small animal internal medicine, Barbara Gallagher. Thank you, Barbara. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, my name is Barbara, as Sammy has described, and I'm delighted to be able to give you this presentation today on canine and feline blood transfusion and donations. And hopefully we'll cover some practical aspects, but we'll also cover maybe some more complicated aspects as well, because many of you will be doing blood transfusions regularly, so we'll try and hopefully provide information that hits all bases. And don't be afraid to ask questions. We'll certainly, I'd be delighted to answer questions as they come along. Okay, so we're just going to try and cover the following topics. As we go through the presentation, I have some frequently asked questions at the very, very end, which hopefully, if you have some more, I can add to them. Okay, so we're going to first begin by starting with donor selection. So many of you may not need to have a donor bank when it comes to dogs because you might be very familiar with using the pet blood bank. So that's certainly the best way for you to get your hands on blood products in the sense that you're leaving it up to them to find the donors, to find to blood type, and to screen for infectious diseases. And that certainly takes a lot of the complicated and hard work out of the picture for yourselves. But sometimes, unfortunately, it's unavoidable. We can't get our hands on blood. Maybe it's in short supply for a particular blood group, or you're not going to get it on time. You've got an emergency patient in front of you. And in those cases, it's always a good idea to have backup blood donors in your database. When it comes to cats, unfortunately, there isn't an established pet blood bank for cats in the UK. So we do have to source our own blood donors for cats. And effectively what we're looking for from these animals is that they're animals that aren't going to be traumatized by having to come in and give blood, that they're reasonably young, but not too young, and the same also not too old. We want them to fit a certain body weight because there's only a certain number of mils per kilo we can take from these animals. We don't want them to be obese to achieve that body weight, and that's really important. The other thing we want is that we want them to be healthy animals. We want them to be fully vaccinated and with really no history of illness. And we'll cover a little bit later on why something even as benign as potentially a dog who was, kicked in the abdomen as a young animal by maybe a horse or something and has to have its spleen removed, why an otherwise healthy animal who's had a previous surgery like that wouldn't be considered a suitable donor. We don't want them to have any history of foreign travel, and we'd even extend that, and you'll see why as we go through the presentation, we'd even extend that to say we don't want them to live with animals that have had a history of foreign travel. We don't want them to have received any blood products because as much as we try to screen for infectious diseases, we can't guarantee that they're not being transmitted. And certainly, we also know that once you've received a blood transfusion before, you make antibodies in response to that, and therefore that blood is more likely to be stimulate other animals' immune systems. And we don't want them to have been in pup or in kitten previously either. All right, so when you make a blood bank, you want all of the animals to be blood typed. Obviously, your preference with dogs is that you get DEA 1.1 negative dogs because they're effectively like the universal donor. But it's okay to have positive dogs in the books. You're just probably going to use, or you're going to be using them for positive recipients as well. When it comes to cats, you really want a mixture of A and B type cats. Now, the B type cats are hard to come by. So if you do manage to source any B type cats, you really want to keep those owners on your good side, and you know, just do what you can really to try and keep them as potential donors. So what we tend to do is we offer them full history and physical exam on an annual basis. We do a full routine bloods on them and urinalysis on an annual basis. And this is what the owner gets from that. They kind of get an MOT in their animal free of charge. And we do infectious disease screening. And that has to inf the type of infectious disease screening you do has to reflect where the animal lives. Now, in Ireland and the UK, like I said, we don't have lots of endemic infectious diseases, but that probably is set to change. But some of you might be working in the UK now, or maybe potentially are working overseas. And depending on what part of the world you're in, you do need to consider what is endemic in the area you live in. So at the moment in the UK, and Ireland, we'd really be thinking about FELV, FIV, and mycoplasma. And when it comes to dogs in the UK, we don't have endemic infectious diseases that are known to be blood transmitted, from the point of view of transfusions, or at least not on a non-experimental basis. So anaplasma has been experimentally transfused from one animal to the next, but there hasn't been any clinical cases reported. But we have this suspicion that many of these diseases are soon to become endemic, some of the diseases that we would worry about when it comes to blood transfusion. We will cover that, like I say, as I go on. So annual screening, full physical exam, full bloods every year, and repeat infectious disease screening. Now, ideally, you don't want to take any dogs on for blood donation that have a history of travel, like I say. You know, there are enough dogs in the UK to not have to do that. When it comes to risk of exposure indoor versus outdoor in cats, you know, unfortunately, it may be very difficult to find indoor-only cats that meet the criteria that are suitable to donate. So sometimes we may have to use cats that do have some potentially limited outdoor access. Certainly, you want to avoid cats that have a history of fighting or getting into to spats with other cats close by. So if you do have cats that go outdoors, then you are going to have to repeat that infectious disease screening before you use them as donors. So that can be quite costly. All right, so we're going to move on to the infectious disease screening. So we want to look for any disease that's obvious to us, so that's overt, and we'll pick that up on physical exam. So if an animal comes in to donate and they have, you know, crusty ears or pale mucous membranes or a heart murmur or something that wasn't there before, then that should be set as a red flag straight away, and that animal definitely should not donate until you can establish why that's there, and potentially, unfortunately, that animal would come off the books for donating, full stop. It is going to depend a little bit on their travel history, and again, this is probably something that's more important for animals that have lived, or for people who work overseas in mainland Europe, where there are lots of different infectious diseases, and you're going to take travel history into consideration. Really, in the UK, we're not going to screen those dogs, but unfortunately, we do have to consider maybe the donor's lifestyle and the housemates they live with. And that may not stop us from wanting to use animals as potential donors, but potentially, if they've a very outdoor lifestyle or they've lived with animals that have lived abroad, there may be a risk that they could have acquired an exotic infectious disease that we wouldn't routinely screen for, but we'd have to consider doing in this particular case. So the kind of recommended testing is anything that has been known to be transmitted by blood previously, and we're going to point out what the pathogenic agents are for the cat and the dog. And again, anything that could potentially be acquired if the animal had ever travelled abroad. And like I say, we're going to really try to avoid using those animals, but probably more importantly, if they've cohabited with an animal who's lived abroad. In other countries, like, you know, if you lived in mainland Europe or the USA and you were bordering certain areas where there were endemic infectious diseases, you might want to screen for those in those particular areas. All right, so this website is called cvbd.org, and it's a canine vector-borne disease website, and it's a really, really useful website. I use it all the time. And you know, where you would use this type of website is just supposing you had a dog come in for a donation or a cat come in for a donation, and you asked about their travel history and they didn't have one, and you asked about their litter mates or their family member dog travel history or cat travel history, and some of the other animals in the house had been imported from some part of the world. Well, what you can do is you can go on this website and you can select the region and you can see what pathogens are actually described in that region and what's the incidence of occurrence. So is it low, medium, or high? And then there's also quite a bit of information on each of the infectious agents. So it's a really useful website. The other time I tend to use it is when we get animals in that have a history of travel, so they're just maybe presenting ill. Then anywhere they've travelled, I'll go to this website and I'll review what infectious agents they're likely to have encountered. And then the other time I'll use it would be animals with fever of unknown origin, where we don't know why they've got some fever, but we have infectious diseases on our mind, along with some other things like inflammatory and immune-mediated neoplastic disease. And because we are getting more and more pet travel around the world, we do have to consider the possibility that some of these infectious diseases, while they may be either of low occurrence or no occurrence in the UK, in animals that haven't travelled, unfortunately, there will be more and more cases reported. So this map is currently showing a low occurrence in Ireland and the UK for the pathogen I had selected, and that was Anaplasma, which is present. All right, so we're going to begin with cats. So this comes from a donor guide that was published in Clinical Techniques of Small Animal Practice. And it was what infectious agents to screen for in cats before you consider using those cats as potential donors. And not just that, but which of them had actually been reported as a potential agent to be transmitted from one donor to a recipient previously. As you can see, the only agent that has been reported to be transmitted was FELV. Now, the others, there are several others that can be transmitted experimentally. And as a result, we do tend to screen for more than just FELV, even though that's the only one that's been demonstrated. So we tend to screen for FELV, FIV, and mycoplasma, hemotropic mycoplasmas in the cat. And when it comes to FELV, previously we used to just use the antigen test, so it's the SNAP test, the ELISA, to try and see whether or not animals are positive, and it's a very sensitive test. But unfortunately, there have been cases described where they have been SNAP test negative but provirus positive. And or DNA positive, and those animals have gone on to infect animals that have received their blood. So now we also do PCR. Now, if you've tested an animal fully once and they're an indoor-only cat and they haven't had new cats coming into the household and all the cats in the household have been tested, you wouldn't necessarily have to repeat test that animal. If, on the other hand, the animal has an outdoor lifestyle, because you have to do a PCR test to test for these animals, and you're always going to do SNAP test first, really, if they have an outdoor lifestyle, you're going to exclude them from your donor group, because you're going to have to be doing this test every time you potentially want to use this animal as a donor. And that gets so costly, it's probably prohibitive. FIV, the same. You know, like I say, while it hasn't been ex while it has only been experimentally transmitted, it's a very common infectious agent, and therefore we definitely must screen for it. And again, we're going to exclude any animal who's got a positive test result or any animal with an outdoor lifestyle. With the mycoplasma group, PCR and cytology are two common ways to test for mycoplasma, hepatotropic mycoplasmas. And PCR is certainly the way more sensitive means of testing. So if you use cytology and you don't see any mycoplasma on a smear, that really doesn't mean an awful lot. And really, if in that instance you don't get anything positive on your smear, you really should be doing PCR afterwards to prove that. So if animals have been previously positive, we don't use them. So even if they've been treated and maybe subsequently shown to be negative, and the reason being is that in particular with the less pathogenic forms, but they're not pathogenic, but with the less pathogenic forms, there has been some evidence that after treatment that they can become infected quite soon again. So we tend to exclude them if they've been previously positive, because we can't really be sure that the infection has been completely eliminated. And if they're outdoor cats again or have poor flea control, it's easier to exclude them if that's possible. So, like I said, this is the publication that's probably worth looking at, where some animals that had latent feline leukemia provirus and transfused to animals that were naive cats that weren't carrying any provirus, and those animals went on to develop, it was 10 cats went on to develop FELV. So very important that we're PCR testing these cats as well as using the SNAP test. Right, when it comes to dogs, we do have a lot more infectious agents that have been shown to be transmitted by blood in animals that have been transfused. So the first one we're going to talk about is Babesia. And Babesia is not endemic in the UK. It's not in the UK, or not up until recently been reported in the UK in animals that had not travelled. But you'll see when we discuss the next few slides that that status has unfortunately changed. Leishmania is certainly common in the UK from the point of view of animals that have been imported from abroad and travelled abroad. I work for Axiom Laboratories and we have on a daily basis multiple Leishmania positive animals, bloods passing through the lab. So certainly there have been reports of Leishmania in animals that have been rehomed from rescue centres where there has been no known travel history, but presumably they have been either imported or travelled abroad and somehow ended up in a rescue centre. So again, not knowing the animal's entire history, we must not exclude the possibility that they could potentially have an infectious agent. And there has been, and we'll discuss this again, some cases where animals haven't travelled in the UK and Leishmania has been diagnosed, and that's been quite recent. Mycoplasma canis is also one that there is a suspicion that it has been transmitted by blood from a donor to a recipient. All right, so this study was done in 2013, so not that long ago. They looked at quite a large number of animals that met the criteria for blood donation. They assessed them all for by PCR for various different infectious agents, and some of those are on the list that we discussed. So the hemotrophic mycoplasmas, Babesia and Leishmania are known to be potentially or have been capable of being passed from a donor to a recipient. And then they also tested for some other infection and Babesia, some other infectious agents like Bartonella and Ehrlichia and Anaplasma that haven't been demonstrated except for experimentally. So Mycoplasma, out of all of those animals, they had one positive and one inconclusive for Mycoplasma, and they had one positive and one inconclusive for Leishmania. Obviously, because those animals had no history of travel, they repeated that testing, and on repeat testing, none of them remained positive. So it's possible that these animals, that there was something interfering with their results at that time, and they felt reasonably comfortable that these pathogens were not endemic or in the wider population in the UK in animals that did not have a history of travelling. A lot of that has unfortunately changed with some of the more recent publications that have come to light. All right, so the first study we're going to look at is an animal that had been diagnosed with Babesia, and there had been a publication in 2006 of an animal who had died from Babesia. It was a dog who hadn't travelled abroad. And at the time, it was hypothesized that potentially that animal had become infected by a tick that had come on a goods vehicle from the continent of Europe. And it was put down to maybe a very unlucky potential set of circumstances. But in 2016, A dog in Essex was diagnosed with Babesia, and the same dog also had angiostrongylus, strongylus, and the dog had presented to a clinic with anemia. And this had led to three further dogs in the area that walked in a similar park, not known to this particular dog, but shared similar walking area, also being diagnosed with Leishmania, or sorry, with Babesia. And then this led to a broader study where they actually looked to see whether or not that parasite, the tick that carries Babesia, whether or not the ticks were actually infected with Babesia. And they looked for Demarcus centrauriculatus ticks, and we know that they exist in parts of England and Wales. And when they looked in the area that these dogs were walking in, I think it was approximately 17 of the ticks that they found actually contained Babesia. And they also did a kind of a wider study where they looked for the same tick in other parts of the UK or in Wales. And again, there was another tick found positive in Wales. So an infectious agent that can be transmitted by that tick that we do not consider to be a pathogen in the UK was found in, I think, potentially 18 different ticks that were identified in this study. And that's quite a scary finding because it means that we're very close potentially to having Babesia as an infectious disease in the UK and in Ireland. So certainly there is the southern part of the United Kingdom is certainly an area that any animal that would present with clinical signs potentially consistent with Babesia or potentially as a healthy animal but suggested as a blood donor, they would really need, in light of these reports, to have full blood work for infectious agents that we would consider exotic tested. All right, so the next paper that I wanted to point out is a report just in April of this year of a 3-year-old dog that was diagnosed with Leishmania. And that dog had lived with another dog that had been imported from Spain, and that dog had been euthanized just 6 months earlier because of signs of severe leishmaniasis. And the way we expect Leishmania to be transmitted usually would be via a sandfly, but there have been other ways. So it has been transmitted from the dam to her pups, and there has been venereal transmission. This animal had never been mated. It has been transmitted like by blood transfusion, which is why we're talking about it. And this animal had never received a blood transfusion. And there have been reports in the States with hounds where it has been transmitted through fighting, so blood-to-blood transmission. So this animal didn't have any of the risk factors. Now, they couldn't sample this particular dog's mother to prove that she wasn't carrying Leishmania, but there certainly was no history, or it was considered unlikely, as while the disease can be latent in animals, the dog was 3 years old by the time its symptoms presented. So, like I say, that the main way it's transmitted is through sandflies, and the particular types of sandfly tend to live in warm areas, and they've not been reported in the UK. So, the route of transmission in this case is a bit unclear. It's not clear whether or not there is maybe another way of transmitting. Another biting agent in the UK who could have transmitted Leishmania from the infected dog it was living with to this healthy dog who had not travelled. And certainly it is a concern with all of the animals that are now being imported from abroad that are carrying diseases like Leishmania, and they can be subclinical and they can be in the park and playing with other animals and potentially be a reservoir for infection to those other animals. And it would make us, quite unaware that these animals could potentially have these infectious agents. There was also a second report. It was just a letter to the vet record, and it was about an English pointer. Again, I think it was a relatively young animal, and it was diagnosed with leishmaniasis. And that animal had also never travelled outside the UK. And the only thing that had happened with that animal is that its owners had travelled to Spain. But they had never taken our animal with them. So the means of transmission in that case is unclear. And like I say, it is potentially this ever-growing reservoir, in particular in the southern part of the UK, that is there of animals that are being brought in from various other countries, effectively rescued, but potentially harmful to the UK population of animals. So mycoplasma is something that is in the UK, and we don't tend to see infectious disease very commonly with hemotrophic mycoplasma in the dog. It's really only seen in animals that have had splenectomies performed or are immunosuppressed. And this is a case report describing a dog who met that criteria. So the dog had had a splenectomy 4 years earlier, and it was UK born, it had no history of travel, it had never received a blood transfusion. So certainly the presence of a splenectomy is considered the most likely risk factor for this animal developing mycoplasma. And it was successfully treated. It was identified by PCR, and this is like going back to the cat when we talked about it. You can look for it on a blood smear or you can do PCR. If your blood smear is negative, then you have to do PCR because you know the sensitivity or the ability to find that infectious agent on a blood smear is very, very low, whereas PCR it's certainly considerably higher. Now, overall, I suppose what I would say is that the prevalence of mycoplasma in the UK is very low. They did other studies where they looked for mycoplasma in animals that were potential blood donors, and out of quite a large number of animals, none of them were mycoplasma positive. So it is relatively uncommon, but like I say, when it comes to selecting your potential blood donors, even an animal who's had a history of a splenectomy for a very benign reason like trauma years earlier, they're not a suitable donor because they could be carrying an infectious disease. All right, so what will it take for some of these exotic infectious disease to become endemic in the UK? Not a lot, really. They just need a reservoir of subclinical animals, so enough animals to infect suitable vectors. We may not have the vectors like the sand fly and so on that's needed for leishmania in the country at the moment, but there have been two cases reported where animals have not travelled and they've still managed to acquire that infectious disease. So there may be other vectors that we're not aware of. And with changing weather conditions, there certainly is a greater risk that some of these vectors will actually, more suitable vectors, will actually become endemic in the UK as well and potentially become, very, very good vectors for spreading those diseases. So with the warmer weather and climate change, there certainly will be more to look out for in the coming years. All right, so that moves us off all of the infectious disease screening. I suppose in a summary, you want to use animals who have no history of travel. You want to use animals that have no history of ever being unwell. You want to use animals that are preferably with cats that are indoor. You want to use animals who don't cohabit with animals who have travelled abroad. And you must do something to keep those owners very happy to bring their animals in for transfusions, or for donations from time to time. So, like I say, we didn't like to give them free things like food or so on because it might promote somebody trying to cost save and potentially, using their animal to do something that the animal may be uncomfortable with just to save some money. But we do need to make sure at a minimum that these animals are healthy, and I think just a health check every year keeps most owners really happy. All right, so we're going to move on to blood typing. So the first thing to say is all of the red blood cells in all of our bodies, dogs, cats, people, they have antigens on their surface. And those antigens, they can stimulate antibody production. So B lymphocytes in the body make antibodies, and those antibodies, if they recognize a foreign antigen, they'll bind to that antigen. So we can see in the yellow circle that the antigen is bound to the antibody, and or the antibody is bound to the antigen rather. And the net result is that they'll destroy that red blood cell. And potentially they could do worse. Now, I just wanted to clear up some terminology because you have something called alloimmunity and autoimmunity. And alloimmunity is when antibodies develop and cause an immune response when the animal is exposed to a foreign antigen. Like, so for example, if blood is transfused from one animal into the other, they'll make alloantibodies in response to that. Autoimmunity is when you make antibodies in response to your own body. So you haven't taken in any foreign agent, you haven't taken in any foreign antigen. These are just the antigens that are on the surface of your own red blood cells. And animals that have immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, they have a form of autoimmunity. Animals that have been transfused and develop an immune reaction, they have alloimmunity. And that doesn't matter, just to try and clear up the terminology, really. So when it comes to antibodies, cats and people have preformed antibodies, and what that means is that the very first time they're transfused, and it just takes a couple of mils, not a lot, they can have a severe or fatal transfusion reaction. And it's because of this, cats should always be blood typed, and they should always be given the appropriately typed blood. And what that means is that you really need to keep those blood typing kits in stock because some of these cats present at the weekend or out of hours when you don't have lab access, and you need to know what type they are. And then if you do have a donor on your books, you need to be able to call that suitable donor in so that they can be the transfusion buddy for this animal. Now, we don't just type cats, we also cross match them, but we'll cover that a little bit later on and why we do that. Okay. Dogs are a little bit luckier. They don't have preformed antibodies, so they can receive their first transfusion without extreme risk of death, at least. Doesn't mean they won't have transfusion reaction, but they're not likely to be having a fatal one. Despite that, it is still best practice that we type dogs before we transfuse them, but it isn't essential. So, for example, if you had an animal who was receiving a surgery, and there was a major bleed during that surgery, and you had access to a bag of blood rapidly, and you didn't have time to go and assess the blood type of the animal, you could just transfuse that dog. Even if it was a DA1 negative dog, you could give it positive blood, and it won't cause that dog to die. So, there are cases where it's really important that we do transfuse. So, for example, every dog after their first trans or that we do blood type, every dog after their first transfusion needs to be blood typed. And there are also other particular diseases where it's important they're blood typed, because if animals are given untyped blood, they're more likely to kill that blood supply off pretty rapidly, and in which case, you're not doing that much better off. You've given a transfusion, and maybe 3 or 4 days later, that transfusion is gone because it wasn't a suitable transfusion. So it may not have killed the animal, but it may not have helped it dramatically either. All right, so the most important thing to remember is that once an animal has been transfused once, they will make antibodies in response to that. So cats already have them before they've been transfused, but dogs and cats, after they've been transfused once, will go on and make more antibodies. Because effectively they've taken in foreign antigen on the surface of the red blood cells into their body, and their B lymphocytes have been really busy, and they've gone off and made lots of antibodies against that foreign antigen. And that's why all subsequent transfusions must be cross-matched. So it's not okay just to say, well, we're going to give the same type of blood to the dog the next time, or the cat the next time, because now not only do they have whatever preformed antibodies the cat already had, but now they've actually made antibodies specifically against whatever antigens they've encountered on that last transfusion. And the same with dogs, they'll have done the same. So when it comes to typing, there are these quick test typing kits for both dogs and cats, and they have been reported in various different studies to be quite accurate when they're compared to the gold standard, which is a tube agglutination, so a manual test to try and determine type. So type A is the most common type in cats, so it depends on the part of the world you live in. In some parts of the world, type A cats make up 95% of the population. A study done in the UK in 2007 reported that almost 70% of cats in that study were type A, and about 30 or so percent were type B, and a very, very small number were AB. But like I say, other studies have identified much higher numbers of type A cats in different parts of the world. Some purebreeds, like Siamese, fall into the type A group, and they're very commonly type A, but you can't make the assumption that because it's Siamese, it must be a type A. Unfortunately, there are always exceptions to the rule, and therefore, even if it is a breed that's reported, it's not 100% of all of those animals. Type B cats, they're certainly less common. And like I say, if you do find a type B donor, hold on to it tight, and treat it and its owner well, because it could be an animal that you need to call on at any point in time if you're faced with a type B cat. From the point of view of that, there certainly are some breeds that are likely to be type B. British Shorthairs, for example, would be one, Devon Rexes. So they have a high incidence of being type B. But they're not exclusively type B, so it might be 50% of them are type B or 60% of them are type B, but it's not 100%. So again, don't make the assumption just because it's a particular breed that it must be a type B or a type A cat. Like I say, those kits, they're very, very useful. They have a long shelf life, so you can easily purchase them and have them on your shelf so that you're able to get these animals typed. And you know, even if you are ordering blood from the pet blood bank, it's always better that you know what type you need to order, so you can always have these kits in house, and they have a reported accuracy in the region of 95%, so they're well worth having on stock. All right, so I just want to run through the blood groups in cats. So effectively we've AB, and then there's this MIK. And from the point of view of what we traditionally had, which was AB and AB, A is the most dominant. So what that means is, if you carry one allele for type A, it's going to be so dominant that even if you're carrying a B or an AB, you'll still be type A. You'll be the phenotype type A. All right. So all of the animals that are A type, they either carry two copies of the A dominant gene, or they carry one copy and another. And because it's dominant, the A copy wins out. For an animal to be a B cat, they have to have two B copies. And the reason being is that that is the most weak or the most recessive. So it'll only be expressed as a B cat if they carry two copies of the same B recessive allele. And then the ABs, they're kind of in between. And you can only be an AB if you're carrying your weaker recessive B together with an AB, or you've got two ABs. All right. The MIK antibody is one that's been identified, or reasonably newly identified, in the last decade in cats. And it's one of the reasons that we encourage people to cross-match cats, because we don't have a commercial test for this MIK antibody or this blood group. So as a result, if we do type cats as being AB or AB, the next thing we want to do is cross match them to see if they're a suitable cross match to a potential donor. So we're effectively looking to see whether there's incompatibility reaction between the donor's blood and that of the animal who's receiving it by doing a cross match. All right, when it comes to, like I said, cats have preformed antibodies, and type A cats have fewer anti-B antibodies. So if a type A cat received a B transfusion, it has less risk attached to it, but still we should avoid doing that. Type B cats have lots and lots of anti-A antibodies. So if you give a type B cat, even like I say, a couple of mils of type A cat blood, there's a really strong likelihood of a severe, if not life-threatening, reaction to that. Maybe cats don't have antibodies to A or B because they carry effectively kind of A and B, but they could have antibodies to other blood groups, like MIK, for example. All right, so type A cats get donate to type A recipients. Type B donors donate to type B recipients. You're never going to give a type B cat A blood or vice versa, but in particular, type B cats receiving type A blood is really, really risky. And in fact, really, we're encouraging that all cats should be cross-matched as well as typed, and that's to try and get around the MIK blood group and any other ones that we're not aware of. Now, the thing about blood groups is that they are you can have multiples of them, so they're inherited and they sit in different locations, so that you don't always have just one blood group, and you'll see this when we discuss dogs. I just want to very briefly mention neonatal isoerythrolysis, and this is where the kittens become rapidly unwell when they have a queen that's a different blood group. And effectively, type B queens should never be mated to type A or type AB. And the reason being is, like we said, this B group of cats, they have lots of antibodies against A. And because they have lots of these antibodies, once the kittens start to feed, if they've produced a type B kitten, then that's fine. That kitten will also have antibodies. But if they've produced a type A kitten, which they can if they're mated with an A or an AB, and I'll show you how in a second, then those kittens will receive this anti-A antibody, and it will destroy their A type blood group. So just a reminder, like we said, A is dominant over B or AB, and hopefully my little arrow will work here so I can point this out to you. So if you have a mum who carries 2B, so this is a very recessive genotype, so 2B alleles, every time she's producing a kitten with, say, an AB cat, then that cat, the queen can donate a B, and the Tom can donate an A. So because A is dominant over B, this animal is a type A, even though they've got a copy of A and B. So the second time round, she donates a B again, and he donates, she donates her second B, sorry, and he donates an A. So we've got an AB again, and because A is dominant, this animal is a type A cat. Next time round, she donates a B because that's all she's got, and he donates an A. And then the next time round, she donates a B. And he donates a B. And this is the only one. So approximately one out of four of these kittens, when you mix an A type sire with a B type female, you'll produce a quarter of these animals as being a B type. So basically, three quarters of those animals will be A type, and then once the colostrum of that B type cat with all of its anti-A antibodies is received by those three quarters of the group that are A type, then you'll get neonatal isoerythrolysis. Now, it's not a disease we see a lot of because I think breeders are so aware of it. So, they screen and they make sure that they don't have it. But like I say, it will result in all these type A kittens receiving type B colostrum, which is full of these antibodies. And that will lead to an acute hemolytic crisis and probably death for most of those kittens. And in some cases, it will cause necrosis. All right, so when it comes to dogs, they're typing. It looks a bit more confusing, but we're not going to get into it in major detail. Effectively, we've got a test for the phenotype DEA1. So we've got this DEA1 positive or negative group. And we have a commercial kit, just like the cat one that I pointed out to you. We've got a commercial kit that will screen for DEA1. And then we've got lots of other blood groups that an animal can have. So they can have, for example, they could be DEA1, 4, and 7. And what that means is that they're positive for those three blood groups. And like I say, blood groups are inherited independently, so you can have more than one. And all of these other ones, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, Dal, we don't have a commercial test that tests for them. So we're not going to think an awful lot about them. But what we need to try and re remember is if we blood type a dog and he's DEA1 negative or DEA1 positive, and just if you give a negative dog negative blood, it doesn't mean that you're not having some conflicting process happening here. And that's what cross-matching is about. And this is what we're trying to pick up to a certain extent with cross-matching. Okay, so do all animals or dogs need to be typed? Well, we've kind of already covered that. No, when we need blood reasonably urgently, we don't need to type a dog. So if we can't, we don't have the time, then that's fine. They can receive their first transfusion without any typing. But it does depend on the reason the blood is required. So if the animal has a non-regenerative form of anemia, so their bone marrow isn't working, so effectively they're anemic and they have no way of actually regenerating their blood, so they may have some disease within the bone marrow potentially as the cause, or they might have chronic kidney disease and not be producing blood because EPO is required to stimulate the bone marrow. So if they have something that means that they're not able to produce the blood themselves, to replace the blood that isn't present, then we must try and give them blood that is the most suitable blood for them. Because the least suitable that blood is, the more likely they are to actually destroy that transfusion, and in which case it's not helped them enough. So like I say, it certainly is best practice. When dogs receive untyped blood and uncross-matched blood, they have on average in one study a 32% chance of having an immunological reaction. And while it's not likely to be fatal in a naive animal, so in a dog who's never received a blood transfusion before, like I say, if it does result in the destruction of those red blood cells in a short time frame, then it's not going to really benefit the animal the way we'd like them to. And these non-regenerative anemias, they can take weeks and weeks to treat. So we don't really want to be transfusing them with blood that isn't going to last very long. I'm going to skip over the next few slides because, in the interest of time, I think they're probably a little bit too complex. Now, they're still going to be in there, and if somebody did have questions, they're more than welcome to answer or to ask me them. But I think that they probably won't help us at the moment. I think the probably most important thing to remember is that there are more than one blood group in dogs and in cats, and that the way we try to get around that is we do cross matching as well on these animals to try and screen for reactions they might have to blood groups that we're not testing them for. So cross matching, so a major cross match, well, first of all, that there are commercial kits available. So there's manual ways of cross matching, and then there are these commercial kits, and the commercial kits are very, very handy. And effectively, what you're doing is you're trying to assess in real time whether or not the recipient's plasma has a problem with receiving the donor's red blood cells. And that's a major cross match. And then a minor cross match is where you're checking to see if the plasma from the donor is going to react with the red blood cells from the recipient. And you only need to do major cross match if you're you need to do a major cross match in all cases, but you only need to do a minor cross match if you're giving whole blood, because that means you're also going to be giving the donor's plasma. Okay, so cross matching, the most important thing to remember here is cross matching is not the same as blood typing. So cross matching, if an animal cross matches as suitable to another animal, that doesn't mean that they've got the same blood type. So you could cross match a type A cat and it might be compatible to a type B donor. But we already said, or it should really be the other way around. So a type B cat, no, a type A cat to a type B donor. Yeah, that's it. So they don't always have lots and lots of antibodies. So type B cats have lots of antibodies, but type A cats do not have lots of anti-B antibodies. So that type A cat could receive a type B transfusion, and actually, potentially, it could cross match as suitable, but it doesn't mean those two animals have the same blood group. The same applies with dogs. So you could have a DEA1 positive dog, and it could cross match as suitable to a DEA1 negative donor. And all that means is that effectively there was not a negative reaction between the plasma of that recipient and the red blood cells of the donor. It doesn't tell us anything about the blood group. And like I say, so we must always blood type them, and we must almost always cross match them. So effectively, like I say, cross matching is assessing the compatibility. And it's trying to prove what would happen if an animal received that blood in real time. So our aim, like I say, if we're giving whole blood, we must do a major and a minor cross match, because we need to know not just how the donor's red blood cells will react with the animal who's receiving them, but also how the donor's plasma will react. When it comes to plaque red cells, we just need to do a major cross match, because all we want to know is how will those packed red cells, what reaction will happen when they're mixed with the donor's blood. So, like I say, if you have a compatible major and minor, or just major cross match, it doesn't mean the animal can't have an immunological reaction. They can still have one, because and first of all, they can have other transfusion reactions, so they're not just immunological. But donors and recipients from suitable blood groups and compatible cross matches have been shown to have still go on and have immunological or non-immunological reactions, and that's the reason that we must continuously monitor these animals. So, when to cross match, so you're always going to type them, like we've already said. And if the transfusion history is unknown, you're going to want to cross match that animal. If they've previously been transfused, so like I said, once an animal's transfused, 3 to 5 days later, they're going to make antibodies to that transfused blood. And what that means is, if you had an animal in the clinic and you had a bag of blood maybe stored from the blood pet blood bank, and you got it in for them, and you cross match them, say on day two. So they received a blood transfusion on day zero. 2 days later, you got in more blood and you cross matched them to that blood. They don't technically need to be cross matched on day two, but if you had, and you cross matched them to that blood and they were a suitable cross match, it doesn't mean that by day 5 or 6 they won't have an unsuitable reaction to that blood, because at that point they've made those antibodies. If the first time you gave a transfusion, you had a transfusion reaction, then it would be sensible to cross match all subsequent transfusions. So even if the transfusion is 2 days later, so like I say, you don't routinely need to do it 2 days later. But if on day zero they did have a transfusion reaction, that may potentially mean that they're carrying other blood groups, or they have antibodies to other blood groups that are going to cause problems. And the slides I've skipped over is where we use cross matching to try and make our donor database as kind of a good universal donor as possible. The same with cats really is as for dogs. But ideally in cats, potentially in all situations, we should try and transfuse them, or to cross match them. All right, so when it comes to blood collection, I'm just going to quickly go through the dog, because you'll probably not be doing this very commonly. So we're going to do a minimal clip on this animal. We're going to elevate both jugulars and try and decide which one is the best. If it's a dog you've used before for a transfusion, then you might want to pick the opposite jugular to the last time. You're going to pop some Emla prep the area and clean it, and then pop some Emla on it. And when you use Emla, for it to work effectively, you have to have it on for about 45 minutes for it to have a maximum effect. So what we do is we put a liberal amount on the jugular, and then you wrap a light dressing onto the around the neck, and that tries to maximize absorption. All right, so we have all of our bits of equipment here that we're going to use, and have all of that equipment prepped because we want to make sure that these animals don't get nervous or skittish, and we want to make this transfusion or this donation go as smoothly as possible. Some animals you might need to sedate. So in some dogs, it does them better to be sedated. Maybe they lie still, there's less risk of contamination of the system. Usually you'll get away with a very, very low dose of butorphanol, just to very lightly sedate them. With cats, there are some groups that do it. The RVC in London, I think, they take blood donations from cats that aren't sedated. You need to have a very well-practiced technique to do that, and you need to be very familiar with the cats. Like I say, for most people who aren't doing it regularly and aren't very familiar with the animal, it certainly is easier to sedate cats, and it's probably a bit less stressful for them too. And the combination we tend to use is midazolam, ketamine, and butorphanol, and usually that will suffice for a donation. All right, so when it comes back to dogs, we're going to place that dog on a table in lateral recumbency, and we'll usually have a pillow or something under their neck, and we're going to use that height to help the blood to flow as rapidly as possible when we're collecting. And we're going to aseptically prepare the site again. The last thing we want to do is introduce infection to an animal who is donating, or into the blood of the animal, into the bag that they're going to donate to. And then you're going to select your appropriate bag. So the bags that we tend to use are human blood collection bags, and they often have that little small bag you can see there on the side. They often have that there, so it's for cross matching with people, for subsequent donations. And the bags come pre-filled with an anticoagulant, so it's usually CPD or CPDA1, and approximately 63 mils of that anticoagulant is in the bag, and that works out at about 1 mil of anticoagulant and maybe 7 or 8 mils of blood. All right, with those types of bags, you've got to make sure that when you're getting ready to place the needle in the animal's neck, that both of those little blue clips are clipped closed. Because, like I say, one of them, it's for people and it's for cross matching. So we don't want our precious blood to go down that one. And the other one, we only open just after we start to see the blood flow down the tip of the giving set. So once you've got your needle in place and the blood starts to come, you're going to unlock the blue clip that's leading to the main bag containing the anticoagulant. And the most important thing here is that you're going to rock that bag up and down, and you're going to try and mix the blood that you're taking in with anticoagulant. And you're going to regularly weigh that bag as well, because you need to make sure that you're not taking too little or too much blood. So if you've got too much blood, you won't have enough anticoagulant to stop clot formation. And if it's too little blood, then the animal will receive too much anticoagulant in that donation, and that also causes problems. So this is kind of a time or labor expensive task, in the sense that it requires a really quiet room and three or four people, somebody to take the blood, somebody to hold the dog, somebody to rock the bag, and somebody to sort of pick things up if they're needed, or reassure the dog. All right, so when it comes to how much you can take, we're aiming to take 450 mils plus or minus 10%. So, like I say, you can take a minimum collection of 405 mils, which would be 90% of that 450 mils, or a maximum collection of 495 mils. And 1 mil of blood weighs 1.0 grams. So you have to weigh your bag regularly. So you need to know the weight of the bag at the start. Add that to what your minimum is, which is 429 or 430, and your maximum, which is 525. And that's what you're aiming for. When it comes to the feline collection, so just to mention something about the canine one before we say anything about the feline one, the canine one is called a closed collection. And what that means is you only ever take the lid off the needle and the needle goes into the dog, and all the rest of it is closed. You don't intervene in any way. But with cats, we don't have that same luxury, unfortunately. So we do a thing called an open collection. And what that means is that we're placing a needle in. First of all, the kit doesn't come as a defined kit. It's not one structured kit. So you're not taking it out, you're putting it together. Now you need to do that in an aseptic manner as possible, because you don't want to contaminate it in any way. And you have, in this picture here, we've got a 60 ml syringe. Usually when I'm taking blood from a cat, I'll have three 20 ml syringes. The reason I'll do that is that if we get 40 mils from the cat and the cat jumps and you're using a 60 mil syringe, you have to unfortunately bin that blood. It's not any good to you, because there's too much anticoagulant relative to blood in that syringe. So you're going to have your syringe pre-filled with anticoagulant. So usually what I'll do instead of using a 60 mil syringe, I'll use three 20 mil syringes. And I'll take out of a canine or a human bag 2.3 mils of CPDA1, and I'll put 2.3 mils into each of those 20 mil syringes. And we'll do the same as we did with the dog. We'll clip the area, scrub it, place alcohol on it, put Emla on it, allow the animal to relax for 45 minutes. Just before they're needed for their donation, we're going to sedate them. And then we'll have our syringes ready. They're pre-filled with CPDA1. They have the 2.3 mils in there. And then we're going to have a small collection bag that we're going to have a three-way tap attached to, and we're going to push the blood that we get into that. But what it means is the kit didn't all come together for us, and we're going to be taking this 20 mil syringe when it's full of blood. We're going to turn in the three-way tap and push that blood down into the bag. When we reattach the next syringe, we know that there's unfortunately risk of contamination, and that's why we call this open transfusion. Okay. So I'm not going to play the video in this case because I think we're running a little bit behind time, but you can watch it, and effectively it's the same really as a donation from a dog. We're just going to work the three-way tap so that once the blood is collected in the syringe, we're pushing it into the bag without having to remove that syringe. And then that syringe is empty and we take off the syringe and place our next syringe, which is filled with 2.3 mils of CPD A1, and we're going to take our next 20 mils off. You're never going to exceed 20 mils in that syringe, because if you do, you'll take more blood relative to the amount of CPDA1 anticoagulant that's in your syringe. And like I say, that's going to cause clot formation. All right, so when it comes to blood storage and usage, if you've collected the sample in an open way, then you need to use that blood more rapidly. So we need to use it within 4 hours if it's been collected in an open method, because it means that there's a greater risk we could contaminate that sample. If it's been collected in a closed method, then we can use it within 8 hours of collection. Now we can also store closed blood. So we can store it, it has to be stored at cool temperatures. For a maximum of 28 days. It can vary with the anticoagulant you're using, but approximately 28 days. And it is important that the bags are stored in an upright fashion. Bags that were stored previously on their sides, lying flat down, appear to be associated with more transfusion reactions and damage to the red cells. And it's also important that the bag is picked up every 2 or 3 days and inverted very gently and mixed to mix the anticoagulant and red cells. Right, when it comes to what kind of blood products we're going to transfuse, we're going to try and use what we think we need, so not anything more than that. So, for example, you might have the choice of fresh whole blood, or you might have the choice of packed red blood cells. Well, if you've got an animal who's got immune-mediated hemolytic anemia, then all they're doing is destroying their packed red cells. They're not doing any harm to their plasma. They're not losing any plasma. They're just losing packed red blood cells. So the animal who's receiving the transfusion probably only needs to receive packed red blood cells. And if we transfused an animal with immune-mediated hemolytic anemia with whole blood, we could over-transfuse them because it would take a lot more because you're also giving them plasma with that blood. You could volume overload that same animal. On the other hand, if you've got an animal who's hemorrhaging, that animal needs whole blood because not only are they losing their oxygen-carrying red blood cells, but they're also losing volume. They're also losing their plasma. So you're trying to transfuse what you think you need based on what the animal has lost. All right, so this slide kind of covers the same thing. The kind of blood products we're going to need. If you're volume depleted and anemic, you're going to need blood. If you're anemic but you have no volume depleted, then you just need packed red cells. If you've got a coagulopathy, then it's going to depend a little bit, but you might just need plasma in that instance, or if you're anemic as a result of it, you might need blood. And if you're hyperproteinemic, you may just need plasma in that instance. So it's going to vary from situation to situation. The next question lots of people often ask is, when do I transfuse? At what PCV? And there isn't, unfortunately, a specific number. An animal who has, for example, been hit by a car or maybe has ruptured their spleen and their PCV drops from 45 down to 20 or 25. That number isn't a bad number, but the drop that that animal has experienced from 45 down to 20 or 25 is quite dramatic. So that animal would need to be transfused because they're probably likely to be showing what we call transfusion triggers. So their heart rate is going to be up, their respiratory rate is going to be up, maybe their mental status is dull, their pulse quality could either be weak or bounding. Your transfusion triggers are really what dictate what needs to happen. Equally, you could have an animal who has lost blood very gradually over a long period of time. Maybe they've had like a chronic bleed from an ulcer in their stomach. And because they've been losing blood very, very slowly over time, their body has learned to cope. So they've kind of got a chronic form of anemia. And that animal could present with a PCV of 8. But they could be very, very stable. They could present as a dog who walks in the door wagging its tail. Just because the number is 8, or just because the animal looks a certain way, doesn't mean that that animal doesn't need to be transfused because obviously they're getting close to problem number when they're down as low as 8. So it's going to vary from one animal to the next, really. Before you transfuse animals, if they're stable enough, you should try and collect the samples you need to test for why they're anemic. So if you can take blood to type them so you know what type blood they should be receiving, take some hematology so you can try and identify whether or not their anemia was regenerative before you started, and take some blood maybe to assess clotting factors. So some animals unfortunately are too unstable and they need to be transfused before you can take blood, and there's nothing you can do about that. But if they are stable enough, try and get the samples you need beforehand. When it comes to how much to transfuse, there's lots and lots of different formulas out there. And really, the formula I've consistently used that I feel is reasonably good, is when you're donating blood to a dog or packed red blood cells, we'll say packed red blood cells in this instance, you can use 1 to 1.5 times the body weight of the animal multiplied by the desired rise in PCV. So if you're trying to bring the PCV up by 10%, then you're going to multiply that by the animal's body weight and by 1 to 1.5, and that will bring the PCV up. And when it comes to whole blood, because you're giving plasma with the whole blood, it's not just red blood cells, then usually 2 mils multiplied by the body weight multiplied by the desired PCV. Now, you can see here there's a little bit more. This is probably one that you'll see in a lot of the textbooks, and that's absolutely fine too. And I have an example of it here in the dog as well. when it comes to whole blood. So you're going to subtract the desired PCV from the recipient's PCV and divide it by the donor's PCV. And just what makes that one a little bit more complicated is sometimes all of that information isn't available. Now, it is important to say dogs would have a volume of about 85 to 90 mils per kilo, and cats in the region of 66 mils per kilo. And I've just plugged the two, I've just multiplied them out here for a cat. So if I use this kind of very simple formula where you say 2 times the animal's body weight multiplied by the desired PCV, it would mean that a 4 kilo cat, if I wanted to increase their PCV by 10%, would need 80 mils. If I use this slightly more complicated formula, but take the same information into account, a 4 kilo cat where I'm raising the PCV by 10%, they would need 88 mils. So they're very similar to each other. Just pick a formula that you feel comfortable with and use that, and make sure that you're not under or over transfusing animals. All right, when it comes to repairing the blood, it's important if you have some sort of system where you have more than one bag that you have a double checking mechanism for cats in particular, because we know if you give a type B cat A blood, that cat is potentially going to die. So have some sort of double checking mechanism. Also have a way to sign the blood out. We do need to warm the blood up before it's given. So you place it into a Ziploc bag and just try to avoid contaminating the ports in any way, and then place it into a warm water bath and start to heat up the blood that's been in. And the same with plasma, if plasma has come out of the freezer. Now, it's important that you never start heating something up and then decide that you're not going to use it, maybe the animal dies, and put it back in the fridge. The exception is with plasma, frozen plasma. If it's been out of the freezer a short time, like potentially less than an hour, and hasn't been started to be warmed up, then you can pop that back in the freezer without losing the clotting factors that are within the plasma. And once it's warmed up, and you start your initial monitoring of the patient that's going to receive it, you attach your giving set, and that's going to include a filter. And in cats, you'll see here a picture of a very small filter that's used. So there's the canine one and there's the feline one. So this little microfilter that's used for cats. And you just flush their IV line with saline and start the transfusion. When it comes to monitoring the transfusion, you're starting out at a very, very low rate. And when you're at that low rate, you're looking for any immediate transfusion reactions. And if you don't see any after about 20 to 30 minutes, then you can start to increase the rate slightly. And you don't want your transfusion time to exceed 3 to 4 hours. So it's going to depend on whether it's open or closed, how the blood that's being donated was collected. So you have to work your timings around that. Now, if you have animals with maybe severe cardiac disease or pulmonary disease, you might need to make sure that you don't volume overload those animals. So you want to use a rate that's less than 4 mils per kilo per hour in that instance. But if it's kind of a 2 or 3 year old animal that needs to be transfused, you can get away with much higher rates in mils per kilo per hour once you've decided that there's no risk of a transfusion reaction. And like I say, in an emergency situation, you just put the blood in if you really think that this is your only hope. All right, so we would use a sheet a little bit like this, where we'd have baseline for the various parameters that are down the left. And then we'd monitor every 10 minutes, each of those parameters. And it's important that you clearly state in your sheet the start time and the end time. All right, so a lot of people feel like they've done their transfusion monitoring during the transfusion and that's where it all stops. But unfortunately, animals can have delayed transfusion reactions. So you should really reassess all parameters an hour after the transfusion is finished, every 12 or potentially 6 to 8 hours after the transfusion. And you should also ask for anybody who's walking that animal to assess for any signs of hemolysis. So that would be a pigment in the urine. Now, some of these animals may have hemolysis, and that might be the reason you're transfusing them. Like, for example, if they had immune-mediated hemolytic anemia. But if they didn't, if they were transfused because they had splenic rupture or something like that, those animals could still have a delayed transfusion reaction, and it could be expressed by you seeing evidence of hemolysis. Or potential evidence of hemolysis by recognizing that there's pigmenturia. And the importance of that would be really it just means that the animal is potentially destroying that transfusion quite rapidly, and may become anemic reasonably rapidly again. Usually we're going to assess their PCV about 4 hours and total protein after they've been completed their transfusion, and then we'll continue to recheck that every 12 to 24 hours, depending on the reason for that transfusion. So, what can happen in response to a blood transfusion? Well, everything can work out perfectly. They can receive the transfusion, there can be no negative outcome. The PCV can increase, and you can be quite happy with yourself. But it's also possible that you could have an immunological reaction. So that could be a hemolytic reaction, and that's when these antibodies that the animal has reacts to antigen on the surface, and it causes a form of hemolysis. And depending on the extremity of that reaction, that could cause a lot of changes in variables that you're monitoring. It could cause collapse or shock, and it could cause organ failure or DIC. So intravascular hemolysis can be very severe. So this is the kind of reaction you might potentially see in a type B cat if it received blood from a type A cat. So if you notice something like that happening, you should stop the transfusion immediately. You need to try and stabilize as much as possible the vital signs that are altered, so the blood pressure and so on. These animals, if they are going into shock, they may need shock rate fluids administered. So important that we're looking out for these types of changes, as rare as they are. All right, you can also have non-hemolytic immunological reactions. So it's where they have kind of like an allergic or an anaphylactic type reaction. And often what they'll do in that type of instance is they'll have like urticaria, like hives or redness or oedema, maybe around the face. And in that instance, you're going to try use antihistamines, and you may need to potentially use corticosteroids. And if the reaction stops, the transfusion can be started again. You can try and go at a lower rate and see if it's tolerated. So if you think they're having an anaphylactic type reaction, that's much more serious. So if you think they're having more than just an allergic type reaction, those animals, again, they're at major risk, and you may need even potentially to give something like adrenaline in that instance. They can also have delayed immunological reactions, and that's where they have hemolysis that's occurring in the days after the transfusion, and this is where you might see pigment in the urine. And the clinical signs in that instance could be very subtle. It probably would just be sort of a sudden drop in PCV. They can sometimes have fever associated with it, and they could potentially develop jaundice. Mostly in that instance, you're not going to do anything about it because it's usually not a life-threatening type reaction. You can also have non-immunological reactions, and this would be maybe potentially infection. It could be bacteria that's been transmitted because the sample has been contaminated in some way. And you can also have transmission of these blood-borne diseases, infectious agents that we've talked about, that you do such a good job in trying to prevent by screening your donors. So I have some frequently asked questions attached at the end that you can have a look through. I don't see any questions on the chat from anybody. So just in the interest of time, because we've run over a little bit, I'm going to close up now. And like I say, hopefully you found this CBD talk helpful, and hopefully it's going to help give you a structure to how you're going to set yourself up for either donations from animals or transfusions, and what to look for in particular post-transfusion, and some of that information about the infectious agents that are now in the UK that are a potential threat, just to raise our awareness of those and be mindful of the fact that we should be screening for them in donors, or even thinking about them in animals that present to us that are sick. So hopefully you found it helpful. If there are any questions that people haven't typed for whatever reason, then feel free to potentially contact CPD Solutions, and I'm sure they can forward them on to me, and I can deal with them afterwards. All right, thank you.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Barbara for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.